Hello and welcome to IVF BFF with me, Sian.
And me, Catherine.
A podcast detailing IVF in real time and shining a light on the experience of infertility.
Join us as we lift the lid and demystify all things fertility, sharing our stories, the highs and the lows, and everything in between.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, guys. Welcome to another episode.
Yeah, we are back.
This is our third ep of the second series, right?
One, two, three. Yeah, third. Yeah.
Third. Wow. Mm. And in this episode, we are so lucky to be joined by the amazing Dr. Grace Lee Brindle, who is a clinical psychologist specialising in fertility.
Yes.
And she's brilliant, isn't she, Sian?
Oh, she is incredible. And she set up her business, which, if I find it, is called Hope in Mind Psychology. And it's to help other people who might be struggling with infertility. And she kind of talks about what her process encompasses and how she can help people and how, you know, it validates a lot of how people feel really throughout this time.
Yeah. So, yeah. She's got her own story as well, which involves secondary infertility and IVF. And it was great to hear her story. And yeah, I'm hoping there's a lot of sort of advice, a lot of comfort, again, a lot of feeling like you're not alone from the things that she's saying, because I think that the same topics come up when it comes to fertility support, and it's the same things that go round, like grief, shame, resentment, all of these things come up over and over again. Relationships.
Yeah.
So we dig into some of that as well. So yeah, I hope you enjoy is the wrong word, but I hope you not enjoy her story, but you know, take something from her story.
Yeah.
I just love listening to other people tell their stories.
Yeah, me too.
Like, every story is so different. And then, you know, we hope that you take something from the chat, the kind of the psychology.
Psychology?
Yeah, that's the word. Psychology side of it.
I think, interestingly, it's kind of come at quite a good time for you, hasn't it, Catherine? Because you are starting.
Yeah, I'm starting therapy next week. I have my 15-minute call with a lovely, I don't know what she is now, whether she's a psychotherapist or a psychologist. I'm not sure. Anyway, one of the two. I've got a session on Wednesday. So actually, a lot of the questions I think I was asking selfishly, I'm like, oh, what about this? But yeah, I am about to have my first session next week. Should I catch up on where I am?
Yeah,
treatment-wise?
Yeah. You've just literally gotten through the door, haven't you? Really?
Yep. We're in Devon this morning. Well, we're in Dorset/Devon. Went to Lyme Regis, which is kind of on the cusp of Dorset and Devon, but so nice. Just a few days away with the dog and Carl. I love how I put the dog first. with Sweep, with my one true love, Sweep and Carl. No, with my two favourite beings in the world, Carl and Sweep. And we booked this because it was going to be a little 2-week wait, distract. But actually it was just nice to have a break and just to not have the stress of a 2-week wait, because obviously our transfer was cancelled. So we had a lovely time. I had a glass of wine last night, guys.
Good.
Naughty. And I had the cake that Sian sent me in the post. She sent me some birthday cake,
which was
delicious. Carl helped me eat it as well. But we had a glass of rosé because I'm not on the meds yet, because we're still waiting for my period.
Which is imminent, right?
Oh, my God. Like, where is it? Any second it could arrive. We're currently on day 12 of my luteal phase.
Right.
Or was that yesterday? I can't remember. Currently, if my period shows up now, it would have been a 12-day luteal phase, which is normal for me. It's kind of, mine tends to be between 10 and 12 days, but it's been 13 days before. So it's not unheard of that it's not shown up. But classic, the one time I really want my period, because when I get my periods, that's when the next cycle officially starts. I start taking the medication for the medicated round.
Ooh.
So I really want it to arrive this time. Just waiting for it to show up, really. But this is IVF, I think. Classic people say, like, when you really want your period to make itself known, it leaves you hanging. Yeah. And I'm just like, come on. I just want to crack on now, really.
And how are you where's your head at the moment?
Yeah, it's all right. I had a bit of, in a bit of a funk today earlier. Mm. Nothing, you know, nothing terrible that I can't pull myself out of. But I think I was quite quiet in the car on the way home. And, you know, Carl was like, you're all right. And I just said, yeah, I'm just feeling all of a sudden when I think about the next round, I get this like overwhelming sense of dread. And I really want the next round. I really want the next opportunity. I'm like, come on, as quick as possible. But also I'm just so nervous. I'm like, I can't even start to think about another 2 week wait and another test. I can't even say the words, like, so just there's a lot of, all of a sudden it becomes quite real. The fact that we're going to have, hopefully, if the prep goes well this time, another very real chance. And when we, as we're told, when we try on our own, naturally, we don't have good chances because of our, you know, our test results, our male factor. So I think as well, driving back from our little holiday, it was sort of like, okay, driving back, period's imminent. I don't know, it's just, it's reality, isn't it? And you go, all right, I'm doing all the new maths, the new IVF maths of going, okay, well, if my period comes on this day, when might a transfer be? And then when might test day be? And then, you know what, I look even further, I go, when would a 6 weeks, is it 6 or 7 weeks you get after IVF? Is it seven weeks?
Well, yeah, usually seven.
Around then. Yeah, I go, when would that be? When would the 12 week be? But, oh, just like, and I'm like, stop. Like, I can't even, I don't know, I'm so aware that nothing's, obviously nothing's a guarantee, but even more than round one, I think. So, yeah, I'm all right. But at the same time, I just want another chance. I want another go. And we're so lucky to be having another go. So,
and you know, I think the stakes feel high, don't they? I think that's kind of where it seems for you.
They do. I mean, we're very lucky. We've got 3 more embryos that are frozen. But after this one, if it doesn't work, our plan is to do another egg collection. I didn't think we'd be entitled to that on the NHS. I thought we had to use up all of our embryos. But in our ICB, they let you have, it's a round is defined as one fresh, one frozen transfer. And so after the frozen, we could elect to just use our last 2 embryos for 2 more transfers. But actually, we could on the NHS get another egg collection. So we have decided that is definitely something we'd be doing.
Good idea.
I know that might be hard for people to hear if they, you know, we've got embryos, but we're choosing to do the whole process again.
Yeah.
But that's the spenny bit, and we get it on the, if we get offered it on the NHS, we feel silly not to take it. I mean, there are people that wouldn't want to, that wouldn't want to do another egg collection, etc. But I just want more embryos, really. So that's why we'd be doing that. So we'd still be, if this one failed, we'd be in a, oh, well, we wouldn't be in a good position. That's a stupid thing to say. but we would have, we wouldn't be out of options, definitely. Yeah. And we'd be in a fortunate position. But yeah, I just think after one fail, your eyes are opened and it will never quite be the same again, maybe. And I do feel like it puts us in a different bracket to people that have never had a failed transfer. And thank God they've never had it. But yeah, I don't know, just cautiously optimistic. But having said that, optimistic nevertheless, you know, like the hope's returning. I'm like, okay, why not? Why not this time, you know?
Yeah.
So all in all, a lot of emotions in my head. Can't wait for therapy.
But that'd be, that's gonna be helpful, I think.
Yes. Back to acupuncture next week and all these things that, you know, just like lucky that we've had some nice things going on. We've had a little holiday. I've got a couple of things over the Easter weekend. Yeah, just taking it each day, really. Like, a bit concerned that the meds are going to make me crazy again. Crazier. But you got to do what you got to do. Carl says he can't tell the difference. He's like, you were fine before on hormones. I was like, I really wasn't.
I mean, it's naive of me probably, but estrogen is usually the stuff that makes you feel good in your cycle, right? But maybe it's
It's a lot. It's a high dose they've given me.
So then,
You know, just waiting for the old period to show, really.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's me, guys. Not much to say this week, really. Just waiting. But anyway, Sian, you all good?
Yeah, fine. Yeah.
Ticking along.
Easter
holidays for you.
Well, yeah.
School holidays.
It feels like it's over. I'm literally back on Tuesday. And I know everyone will be like... Yeah. I mean, I went to the hairdressers today and they were like, you've had what?
It looks
3 weeks? Oh, thanks. It's a bit short, but it is nice. But that's was literally like, you've had 3 weeks off? And I was like, yeah, and we go back on Tuesday. And she was like, you've literally had nearly a month off. I'm like, I know.
Oh, but guys, teachers work so hard.
Mm.
And there's that like, do you get like the Sunday scaries after the holidays?
Yeah, always. I literally can't sleep the night before going back to work. So... But it's fine. It'll be what it'll be. And it's also
sunnier
summer.
Days. Summer. Yeah, sunnier days, lighter evenings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. I think we better crack on with the app.
Yeah.
Let's do it. This is Dr. Grace Lee Brindle. Hope you enjoy. I'm just obsessed with her now. She's a mega babe.
She's amazing. Love her.
She's great. Yeah. Enjoy, guys.
Yeah.
And we'll speak to you after.
Everybody, we have Grace Lee Brindle here today.
Hi guys. Yeah, we're so lucky today to be joined by Dr. Grace Lee Brindle, who's a clinical psychologist. Did I get that right?
You did, yeah, that's me.
Hooray.
Hi Grace. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for coming.
So I found you, Grace, on Instagram not too long ago. I think somebody recommended you to me.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and a friend kind of put me onto you. And I remember scrolling down your Instagram feed and just every post I was like, yes, 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 yes. And you were bringing up so many kind of great topics and, you know, brilliant stuff that we all kind of feel going through infertility. And so that's how I found you. And I thought, and I don't know, I think I've replied to a few of your stories and stuff, and we were like, we should collab. And so here we are.
Yeah, and thanks so much for inviting me. I'm very pleased, and I've listened to a couple of your podcasts and loved them, and think you guys are doing such a great thing, because like you say, so many people are so alone and lonely in this experience. So yeah, the more we can kind of get our experiences out there and make people feel less alone and normalise their experiences, the better, I think.
Yeah, and it's still such a taboo subject.
Absolutely, yeah.
But that's so odd, isn't it? I mean, so many people suffer.
Sadly, yeah.
Yeah. So I wondered if, you know, Grace, you could tell us a little bit about your sort of journey, your experience of infertility.
Of course, yeah. So I am experiencing secondary infertility, and I know that that is a kind of hard thing to hear potentially when you're in primary infertility space, because, you know, I'm super lucky to have a child and I'm fully, fully aware of that. So I guess that I want everyone to know that, really, that like I know how lucky I am, and I think everyone almost in the secondary infertility world does, but they also can't stop that want for number two. So I think it's like living in that space of like, you know, desperately wanting another whilst absolutely loving the one you've got. And I think it's, you know, it can be a hard balance sometimes, but just to say that. So my journey to number one was relatively easy, also another hard thing to talk about in this world, but I would be lying if I said anything else. So that's just the case. And because of the work I do, I've worked in baby loss before, as well as my specialism has always been perinatal mental health, and worked a lot with fertility. Before number one, I always said, if we're lucky enough to have children, not when, you know, when everyone else has that assumption. I never did. I kind of always knew that it was a question.
You know too much, don't you?
Yes.
Emma, the embryologist, said exactly the same thing. She's like, when you work in this space, you think everyone's infertile.
Yes, so. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I was, yeah, and I, you know, yeah, I can remember kind of thinking this will probably take ages, but you know, like I really didn't just take it for granted that I'd have a baby easily, but actually it was relatively easy. And then, so I think it lulled me into a full sense of security with having a second. Again, I still said it out loud, like, you know, if we're lucky enough to have a second, but I kind of didn't at that point fully believe that it, in the same way as with primary, you know, when I was trying for my first. And then, so yeah, I'm 3.5 years into trying for baby number two and having a pretty rubbish time of it, really. It's been yeah, it's been a journey. Like, it's always that word, isn't it? But
a journey. Yeah. I think it's worth saying, Grace, as well, that you're so sensitive and you're so lovely, and in acknowledging that it's different from primary infertility, etc. Because Sian and I, well, I am still experiencing it, and we're both in the primary club. But honestly, I think it's so important you coming on to speak about this, because this is another area of infertility that neither of us can represent.
No.
So, and it will. There will be so many people in your position, and I had a little glimpse of that when I think with us our bar gets set a little bit lower, because initially we all picture our, well, a lot of us picture our families with more than one child. People like me and Sian then realize that one is going to be really difficult, and the bar is lowered, sadly. But I had a little glimpse of that, and I've always kind of said, well, you know, I just want one, probably quite narrow-mindedly. Not disregarded secondary, but I do admit that I struggled to get my head around the secondary infertility. But then when I thought, now we were lucky with our embryos, we did well with our eggs collected. But when I learned that we were going to get fewer eggs than I hoped for, I remember being in the pharmacy waiting for my meds, crying my eyes out on the phone to my husband going, I just wanted my family. And that was the first little glimpse that I got of like, oh, that must be kind of what it feels like. And it's that picture, isn't it, of how you see your family.
And that's it. Like, you can't help but kind of, if you've had that image in your mind of what your family will look like, it takes a long time to adjust to a different idea. And I think I am gradually adjusting to the idea that it might just be one and that will be okay, but it isn't what I want, what either of us have wanted. Also, when you're living with secondary, you're living with the letting down your child, because there is that like feeling that they want that, you know, it's really hard. But my daughter is like, loves other little people, and she'd ask for a sibling, you know, she asks for a sister all the time. It's that part of it that's really difficult. But you know, I work loads of people with primary infertility, probably predominantly, although I do both, and I think, you know, I don't want to take away the pain it would feel like to think that you might not get even one. Like, that's so much worse. So like, well, for me, although I know we've talked about this before, that actually I've spoken to quite a few people now that have said, having experienced both primary and secondary fertility, they've struggled with the secondary infertility more, which actually I struggle to get my head around, and my job is to get my head around people's experiences of things. But yeah, so I guess it's so individual for different people, but you know, I can't believe what that would be like, you know.
My mum really struggled to have me, and when she did have me and they were wanting a second, my sister is actually adopted from China, actually, but she told me one of the most heartbreaking thing was that I kept asking for a sibling. And I used to come on a weekend bring down all the teddy bears and line them up in front of the telly and be like, well, that's my sister, and then that's my, do you know what I mean? And said it really hurt her, it like broke her. So I can imagine how hard that must be for you, and I'm so sorry.
My daughter does come back from nursery and tell me that her best friends are her sisters and things like that, and it's because she's living out this desire that she has but she can't have, like. So yeah, that is like, I think it's one of the most difficult parts of secondary infertility, for sure. It's actually not about you so much as about them.
If you could take us back, if it's okay, if any of this is too much, you don't have talk about it, but take us back to when you first started trying for number two. And if you wouldn't mind just walking us through your sort of secondary journey so far.
Yeah, of course. So, we probably tried for, I think we said to the GP when we went that we'd been trying for a year, because I knew the system, I knew to play it a bit and
maybe, oh yeah, been there.
add a few months on.
Same.
But to be fair, I didn't, you know, like actually the NHS are going to do very little for us because we're secondary affinity, which I totally understand. I wouldn't expect them to. Like, there's far more people of priority. But anyway, so I think I started worrying around the 6 month mark when it wasn't happening. Because we had the comparison with the first as well. And that's when I started thinking, oh, this feels weird. And then I think at that point, that's when I'd had a really difficult birth. Right. And my daughter was born not very well, and it was all quite traumatizing. So I think, like, my psychology brain does the psychology brain thing that it does, where it's like, oh, maybe this is, well, at the time it was either like, is it the stress of the experience that's happened and what that means, and is my body blocking somehow, none of which I really believe, but like you kind of make up, you try and make these reasons, don't you? And I also was thinking, is it the C-section? I had a C-section. Is it stuff to do with that? Is that why I can't get pregnant? Like, that's where my brain went. So I was kind of looking past my old medical notes, all that sort of thing, trying to work out why, and like doing a lot of Googling as we all do. But yeah, so that's when I think I started worrying, went to the GP a few months after that, had some standard testing, nothing particularly wrong either way. My AMH is high, possibly into like PCOS territory, even though I don't have any other symptoms. My partner's sperm morphology is slightly on the lower side. Everything else is fine. So it's like that. It's not ideal, but it shouldn't be stopping us, especially with IVF and ICSI, shouldn't be stopping us getting pregnant, really. And then I remember, because we have to fund it all ourselves, so I was a bit like, when do you start taking this leap? Because it's just, you know, astronomical amounts of money. And then I it's hard to remember my timelines, to be honest, but I think we went to a private consultant, and I was expecting her to just go, right, IVF, let's just do it. And I think that was around 18 months in. But actually, she thought we should try ovulation induction, which, looking back, what a waste of bloody time.
Oh, really?
really wish I hadn't done that. Well, because like, there's no sign that I'm not ovulating. Like, my AMH is good. Like, there's none of that. None of that's questionable, really. So I was like, why are we? I don't really understand why we're doing this.
And do they, that where they give you medication and you have to take that?
Yeah. Yeah, right, so it's okay. You get given, I had Clomid, but there's another one. I'm really, Letrozole, thank you, now that people use more because Clomid's so awful. Yes, they basically, it increases the amount you ovulate. So it will either start you ovulating if you're not, or if you are ovulating, it should increase the amount of eggs you produce each month, and therefore try and increase your chances of getting pregnant. But I mean, what it did for me was give me ovulation hyperstimulation
syndrome. Did it? Oh
yes.
My god.
Yeah, and actually they didn't warn me about it because it's so rare to have it from Clomid or from ovulation induction. It's much more common in IVF, but really rare in ovulation induction. So they hadn't warned me, and suddenly I was just like, I feel absolutely horrific. I couldn't walk. Like, I remember like hobbling down the street. Actually, I saw my consultant in town as I'd like dragged myself out to get a coffee because I was like, I can't stay in the house this whole time. And I almost wanted to run after and be like, look what's happening to me, but she was just off on her way, and I was like, I probably shouldn't do that, that's not very appropriate. But I was like, please tell me what's happening, because at that point I hadn't even like worked out what was going on. So anyway, we did that for 3 months. They reduced the dose massively after that first round, but nothing happened. And then from that point we were like, let's just crack on with IVF now. I'm fed up, really. All arrows were pointing that that's the way it was going to be. So
sadly, I think that's quite common in fertility treatment, that all roads, and other people, holistic people might tell you differently, but a lot of doctors will kind of say all roads lead to IVF. And we had the same thing with my husband's male factor. A lot of people said, well, you know, get that looked at more, which we still might do if this next one doesn't work, etc. But doctors will say, well, it's ICSI or ICSI.
That's really the thing, like with male factor, the solution to male factor is ICSI. So why find out, like, do you know what I mean? In a way, it's kind of hard to, And I know that there's lifestyle things and things, but actually I have some issue with the lifestyle changes, because I think in a way it makes you feel like actually that it might be your fault, or that you haven't done something right in the first place, or also the mindset stuff. Or just think positively and it will happen.
Grace. Oh my God. Honestly, this is music to our ears, because this is the other thing, is I feel like there's almost a little bit of a stigma as well when it comes to like
infertility.
Infertility. If you say to someone, oh, you know, something like, you know, oh yeah, well, we're going to have to, you know, have IVF or ICSI, or they immediately put you in the unhealthy camp. And it's so annoying, because you're
Are you doing this? Are you not doing that? Is it because you did this?
Like, it's a blame game.
Especially with unexplained.
Yes.
Which is even harder. And Sian, you had a taste of that as well, didn't you?
Yeah, because our consultant was just very like, we don't really know why, to be honest. Could be a bit of male factor, could be unexplained, more likely unexplained. We don't know. So we'll do ICSI anyway, because why not? And I was like, you know, no one knows.
Yeah, so. It's so hard. And it's hard not to get really frustrated at them, because they're doing their best ultimately. But like, I'm like, surely there's more we could be investigating and trying to work out what's going on and all that. But I think in like, maybe in our lifetime even, we'll look back and be like, oh my God, if we were going through this, you know, what we went through now, there's more to, you know. But right now, that's just not, it's just is, it's IVF, isn't it? That's basically the outcome.
So what kind of happened next for you?
So in January 24, I had my first round of IVF.
Was it IVF or ICSI that you got
ICSI,
recommended?
Sorry. ICSI. I always say IVF, but it's ICSI. Both ICSI. So yes, ICSI in January. I had ovulation hyperstimulation again, so really pretty rough. But I have loads of eggs, 24 eggs collected, like, and they like amazing. And you think like, that's such a high. Like, I can remember coming out of egg collection and then being like, oh my God, we got 24, it's amazing. And like, we're so happy.
Job done.
Yeah. And then we were like, great, well, surely, then you look up the odds and you're like, surely one of those little guys is going to make it into something. How wrong we bloody were.
Right.
So the next call is like, they're not doing very well, any of them.
Oh.
And then basically it got to transfer day and they called, and my partner had to go to America, which is just the world's worst timing, and he would not have done it for any other like thing. It's like the one work event he was like, it's just so hard for me to miss. I mean, in retrospect, we're both like, that was bloody ridiculous, why did we do that? He would never do that again, I don't think. But at the time we were just a bit naive, I guess, even despite the work I do and everything else. And also, I think by that point, we just thought that they were not going to transfer anything. So we were a bit like, go to America, it's fine, because, like, nothing's going to happen. But the day of transfer, they were like, actually, there's two that are doing, you know, they're there. They haven't completely arrested. They're not blastocysts. But you can transfer both of them if you like, just to have a crack. And
What day were they? Sorry.
Day 5.
Oh, so they were day 5.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's just two out of the 24 that hadn't fully arrested. We also had really good fertilisation rate. So fertilisation rate was good. And then they just from there went bad. My lovely friend had already said that if I was having transfer, that she absolutely would take me, because I was like, no, it's fine. She's like, I'm absolutely not leaving you to do that by yourself. So luckily, I'm so thankful for her, she went along with me. Because then when I got there, because of the ovulation hyperstimulation, they were like, we shouldn't really do a transfer.
Oh my God.
I was like, but you're telling me we can't freeze these blastocysts, they weren't blastocysts, these embryos, so like like, oh, surely you need to do a transfer. So I had, after like 3 different consultants coming into the scan room to look at how much fluid was in my abdomen and all the rest of it, I signed my life away and had them transfer 2 really rubbish embryos. So I don't know, like, I think back to that sometimes, I think maybe I shouldn't have done it, because actually the outcome was I did get pregnant. But we were always a bit unsure about it, because the chances are so low, like the miscarriage rates are so high with embryos that are transferred that aren't blastocysts anyway. So although there's always hope, right, I obviously was hopeful, because like, as soon as you have that positive test, it feels like, oh, this is the closest we've been for 2.5, wherever we're at, years. But anyway, a few days later, got a negative test. and that was the end of that round.
Sorry, Grace. What a bloody roller coaster. I know that's a cliche,
yes,
but
it is. Yeah, it's what I say all the time, though. It is a roller coaster. It's hard, like with some of the stuff, because it is a cliche. You know, you are living the cliche, really. But yeah, it was a real roller coaster, and it really hit me, you know, very hard, because like I think when you're on the first round of IVF, you've kind of drummed up to be this answer, like, oh, like this is the thing that we're going to do that's going to make a difference, right? Like, it's going to be the cure, and lots of people assume it's really, the success rates are so much higher than they are. Obviously I knew it, they weren't, but like, you just have that hope that you're going to be the lucky ones that it happens for first time, and it didn't, so that was really shit. And then we had a break. Oh yes, I had to have, they put me on PCOS treatment, inofolic and metformin, because of the hyperovulation, the hyperstimulation, to try and avoid it happening next time, even though I don't have any symptoms of PCOS other than the high AMH and lots of eggs. So they put me on that and wanted me on that for 3 months before we went for next round. We did all of that. And then did next round in May. Pretty much exactly the same thing happened to me in May, other than there was no positive pregnancy test. It just didn't work that time. But two poor embryos transferred. That was all we had. Nothing to freeze again. Actually, slightly differently, which was almost annoying, because after the first round, it was so bad that they started talking to us about the options at that point, even though we'd only had one round.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so, and then we were like, they were kind of like, egg donation is probably your only hope if it doesn't work this time. And then annoyingly, that was because of when they arrested, the fertilization rate was good, so they assumed the sperm was fine. In our second round, the fertilization rate was also very poor. Really loads of eggs again, poor fertilization, and then arrested. And so then they were like, oh, now we're not sure if it's just the eggs or if there's also a problem with the sperm, we can't tell you, we don't know, bloody bloody blah. So then we were even more confused, because we were like, set, that's it, we'll just, not just, it's not easy, but like, we'll do egg, you know, like, we'd got our mindset on that will be the next thing we do, and then it just confused things no end. But actually I was like, look, you said egg donation, let's just go for it, because I have a twin sister who is very lovely, and she had already said that she would be willing to donate her egg. She's had her family and is all done. I say that, she always holds on to potentials. But anyway, she was done enough that she was willing to go there. So that was our next step. She got diagnosed with POI. I can't think of what that stands for. Premature
ovarian insufficiency. Yeah.
Gosh, you know all of the lingo, Catherine.
Mate, I've been on fertility Instagram for a long time.
Yeah. she got diagnosed with premature ovarian insufficiency through the process of starting to donate her eggs to us.
Never straightforward, is it?
No.
So that was horrendous for everyone, really, because she got a shitty diagnosis that luckily she's had, you know, the kids she wants in a way. So, like, you know, it's not, but still, it's horrendous. And it's actually a very significant diagnosis, regardless of whether you are wanting to have more children or not. It has a big impact. So that was really shit. I felt shit for her realising it through my path. But actually, she said, like, we'd never have realised it otherwise. And she can get on the medication she needs and all the rest of it. So in a way, it was a positive, but it was just another, like, oh right, of course, like, that's that option's not going to work then. And then two more friends offered. The clinic weren't keen on them because of different medical stuff that they had going on. And then my consultant, a different one to the first one, that said we needed to use egg donation, was like, actually, I don't know if I'm ready to give up on the idea of your eggs yet. I was like, oh, but I kind of was. The thought of going through the same process again and just having nothing again, like, that, it's not as if we were close, like, it was so bad, like, and twice, it just felt like, oh my God, it's insanity, doing the same thing over and over and getting different results, expecting a different result, right?
And this is it, and I feel like this is the thing where we talk about primary infertility, secondary infertility, but no matter where you are, that is horrific to go through, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it doesn't really matter if it's your first or your second or your fifth or your...
I think if you're in the place... Loss. Yeah, and I think you're in a place, if you've committed to that space of wanting a baby and it, you have that journey and it doesn't happen, like it's a loss, right? And that's the thing with fertility, it's loss after loss after loss, like and it's so hard. And I just, at that time, I just didn't think I could do it again. But anyway, we decided that we would listen, and what we've decided to go for is, which I've never really, and I've done, like, you know, I work with people in this space quite a lot, we're doing my eggs with half donor sperm and half my partner's sperm, but we would know they go separately and we would know whose is what. But basically they're like, we don't want to do exactly the same thing because you're probably right, we'll get exactly the same results, but we could try donor sperm, which is an easier process than egg donation in lots of respects, in terms of, like, you know, finding the, you know, it's just kind of legally and things a little bit less complicated. So that's where we're at. We're about to do that in November, having chosen the sperm donor, which is a very, very weird process where you get, like,
what's
sent
that
a,
like?
You get sent a brochure. No. Not in the UK. I think in other countries, or if you go through, like, European companies, you can get pictures, but if you go for the UK, you don't get a picture. It's very, very anonymous. But you get, basically, it's a bit like, well, you get a brochure, like, this is, they get given, that's not the right word, you know, a different,
like,
name,
false like an alias.
Yes. Oh, yes. Okay. Exactly. And then they're like, you know, I like this and I do that and I, this is my job, and they write, like, a profile, you know, like, really? why they're doing it, that sort of thing. It's a very, I mean, it's a lovely thing to do, really, isn't it? Like, anyone that kind of does that for people is just, you know, great, like, amazing. But it's just a very weird process to be on the other end of. And, like, some of the people were like, oh, I did this because I wanted to, like, have more kids in the world. I was like, that feels very ominous. Like, no, thank you. I, like, was like, that's one of the things I really cared about. Because the message gets given to your child when they're 18, regardless. In the UK, if you have UK donor sperm or eggs, when the child turns 18, they have a right to their name, the last known address, and they get a message from the donor.
Wow.
So it was really important to me that didn't fuck up my child, basically, when they received that message in the nicest possible way. So like, that was a really important, the message was a really important part for me. But yeah, and actually we tried to do the whole, like, let's look for someone that looks like my partner, who is pretty, like, he looks Mediterranean. Most people think he's not from the UK, but actually that wasn't an option. Most of them were, like, blonde, blue eyes, and we just were like, oh well, this one will do. It was really a bit like that. I've honestly spent longer picking my outfits, in a way. Because I think where I was coming from, when I talked to my, I got really overwhelmed to start with and then ignored it for a while, and then I was like, actually, I'm a psychologist, I believe so much in, like, nurture and, like, you know, the environment 100%. You bring children up in, and, you know, there's things that you can't change, like their eye colour and, you know, stuff like that, but ultimately, you know, we know so much now about epigenetics and how we actually change the, you know, change gene expression based on the environment we give our kids and things like that. And so I thought, actually, just gonna take a punt. Yeah.
And I think when you go down this path anyway of building your family in a maybe a less conventional way, the idea of family to you changes anyway.
Absolutely.
And your eyes are open. It's maybe one of the few positives about infertility is your eyes are open to so many ways you can have a family, and it's not the conventional thing that we're all brought up believing. So
And you I think you gradually, as you go down the path, change what, you know, you start adapting to the next idea, because when the first idea isn't what, you know, like, it's just a gradual process of moving along that journey and seeing different alternatives. So anyway, November. I was due to do that.
Oh my goodness.
And then the day before I was due to start my stims, I had my blood test. I had a routine blood test, and it came back, and my thyroid was massively overactive. And I did say to Mike, I'd been feeling really anxious, but I thought it was down to the next round of IVF. But I'm not like I'm quite controlled in my emotions, in a way. So I was like, oh, it's been a bit weird. So I was like, oh, that explains it. I've been feeling like, you know, like my heart had been like physical anxiety, and my heart had been pulsing, and I was like, okay, that makes sense. And then I found out quite quickly that was a no-go from fertility side. If you get pregnant with overactive thyroid, it's really quite dangerous for you and baby. Yeah.
Wow, and they don't test that, do they, when you're about to start fertility treatment? I don't think I ever had thyroid.
I think you will at TSH. You will have at the start. Clinics do. You have to have a panel. Once a year you'll have it done. And that's the interesting thing. I was like, at least this might explain things, but no, because my thyroid a year before and a year before that had been fine, so it doesn't even explain the infertility.
Why did that happen, do you know? Or
they can't really tell us. There is some link with stress and thyroid difficulties, which, you know,
just what you need to hear.
Yeah. but they don't really know why. It's just a bit of a fluke thing, but it was massively overactive. Also, then they put me on medication for it, and you can't get pregnant on the medication either. It's really dangerous. So, like, we were in a world where we were starting to use protection again, which was biggest mind fuck ever. Like, I was like, are you actually joking? Like, yeah. I cannot believe this is my life. Like,
the what if goes, like, least, like, when you're unprotected, you've still got that what if.
This little what if. Yeah. Yeah.
Like that 1%, it could be. Yeah.
Because even though, like, I've almost completely shut my mind off to the idea this would remotely happen naturally now, like, actually it does to people. You know, you hear of those stories of 3 years in, 4 years in, whatever, you know, so yeah. But equally, I mean, in a way, there was a silver lining that taking away that what if did give me a bit of headspace for a bit, you know, like,
yeah,
okay,
yeah, because I'd been 3 years in at that point, you know, so I was like, actually, it's the first time where we can kind of completely shut off from fertility because nothing can happen. So then, yeah, that's where we are now. Really, it's gone from overactive to underactive to like bobbing around, kind of getting a bit better. They've said if it stays stable, maybe in the next few months we'll be able to go. And I'm on some medication for underactive thyroid now, which isn't as dangerous. You can still have it whilst trying for a baby. So as long as it stays stable on that, then we can go again, which feels petrifying.
Yeah,
I bet.
It sounds like you know, all this, you know, we all know that when it comes to infertility, waiting is the big thing here, but it just sounds like for you it's just been constant kind of next hurdle, wait,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, there's been lots of limbo of just like, okay, now I have to wait for this medication or that, yeah, like, which I think is, you know, talking about kind of the themes I hear in my work, like the waiting is like one of the hardest things because you're not in a place where you can feel like you're doing something, and so you feel so hopeless.
100%. I always feel better when I'm in a treatment. So even the last, we tried to do a natural transfer, didn't, my cycle was wonky, didn't happen. Which is a bit annoying.
It's gutting though, because you do kind of emotionally work yourself up for it,
it still felt like treatment, even though I wasn't on any meds. I still was treating it like treatment. I was like, right, okay, the wine was gone, like all the right things, like looking ahead to the dates, doing the IVF maths, like, drives us all crazy. But I prefer even doing that. And then when you're in a cycle, you can at least have those like markers, and you've got to do, whether it's taking it like medication or whatever. But I always feel like I spin out way more in those in-betweeny bits when they say just have a cycle, or wait for your next cycle, or have a cycle off. You're like, no,
don't want to. I want to carry on. I want to crack on with this. Left to my own devices, I'd have done, like, you know, I'd have just cracked on and done cycle after cycle. Probably it's not the best idea. I'm sure the, you know, consultants know what they're talking about, but it's so much easier, I think, in that, not, it, you know, it's hard in lots of other respects, but it's so much easier being in that active process. And I think the other thing for me was my work is, so in August I left the NHS and moved to private work, but before that I was working in an NHS perinatal mental health team, which was really hard. I'm triggered less by people with just one baby because of my journey and where I'm at, but I was, I remember sitting in our clinic waiting for my client, and she had multiple, let's say multiple children who were on child protection plans and she was struggling to look after. And she had told me she wasn't using protection. And I had a moment of like, if she comes in this room and tells me that she's pregnant, I'm not going to keep my cool. I'm going to be really, really upset. Yeah. And I was like, actually, this is a time, you know, I need to check in with myself here and realise that this is not a good, you know, this isn't good. I need to step back and have some space from it, because it's not, if I'm not feeling good in the work, then it doesn't serve my clients either. And my work, my predominant work was in bonding, mother and baby attachment work. So it's like so vital to be able to be emotionally attuned to both of parent and baby in that moment. And I just wasn't able to.
We hear about it a lot, you know, people that, I know of people who are midwives, who are, you know, embryologists, etc. Mm-hmm. And like you, that work in this space, and you're too close to it sometimes, you know?
Yeah, it's really hard. And actually, people are like, but you moved into the fertility space. I had done some fertility work previously, so it's not as if it was a new area. There's so much overlap with perinatal and fertility. But I'd worked with fertility where people had then had a baby. So like the traumatic elements of fertility and how that impacts when you've got pregnant or had a baby and that sort of thing, or baby loss, where people are then still in the fertility space trying for a baby after loss. So had worked in fertility a lot, but not kind of as much with it being specifically about fertility, but I had done some. But actually, it feels much easier to me to be in this space. I'm making a positive thing out of my shit experience. And yes, I can't fully get into the head of people with primary infertility, but you know, there are so much overlap with the trauma of the journey, with the ongoing like weight, you know, there's so much overlap with it that I think people find it really helpful that I can understand some of the medical stuff, some of the experiences, that I can get it on a level that other clinicians might not be able to, like, they don't have to explain, like, you know, explain in depth what all of it means and things like that, or, you know, just how hard it is, you know, because I kind of have that knowledge. So, yeah.
Can I ask, when you're working with people, are you quite open about what you're kind of going, what you have experienced when you're talking to people? Because I've always had, whenever I've had therapy, it's always been very, like, the therapist doesn't want to share anything about their lives. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And we're very much trained to be a blank slate. Like, that's what they call it. Like, we should be like a nothing so that people can just give us their everything. And like, but I think the world is moving away from that, because people are really, like, the way people even find therapists now has changed. And what people want is people that can understand and people that are human. And, you know, I didn't take it lightly that I was putting my story out there in a time where I'm going to work in the same area. But I don't know if you've heard of Miracle Moon. She does, she helps mums that have had NICU experiences, but she had her own experience of and anyway, she was doing basically what I wanted to do for the fertility world for the NICU space. And like, she was just negotiating it so well. And I kind of thought, like, I would love to be able to do this. And so what I say to clients is that, like, because most people find me from Instagram, so they know my story. It's there to access and gain. Mm. And so it's just a process of setting it up. Like, I'll say, you know, ultimately, you can ask me questions. I don't mind. I might tell you I don't want to answer them. And we'll just have to respect each other's spaces with that. I'll also be very mindful if our therapy is becoming more about me than about you, because that's not what we're here for. We're here to talk about you. And so for the most part, we don't talk about me really ever. It's really rare. But it's just their knowledge that they, you know, they've seen the Instagram stuff and they know I get it on a level maybe that some people don't. And that's enough to help them, even though, like, in therapy in the moment, I'm very rarely drawing on my own, like, active. I'm drawing on it because I can empathise due to it, but I'm not talking about it often.
I think as well, what it is in this space, when you find someone that gets it, it's so rare, because so many people who haven't been through it don't get it. They do their best and they try, but I've certainly found it with my acupuncturist. I don't know lots about her journey, but you know, I know that she's had a journey, and I just went, oh, okay, you get it in a way that other people can't necessarily. Exactly. So I do think it's reassuring, but like you say, there's got to be a bit of distance, hasn't there?
Yeah, it's just making sure that, because, you know, there's like, when you're there's so much in the therapeutic relationship, and you have to be so aware of things like avoidance. And, you know, it could be so easy it would be really easy to fill an hour asking me questions rather than going into their own stuff. Mm. And it's my job to make sure we're not moving to the space of avoidance and go into places that are useful for my clients rather than talking about me. I don't want to talk about me in my therapy, like in therapy ultimately. I have my own therapy for that, for good reason.
Oh, that's good. Interesting with therapy sometimes, because whenever I've had it, I've had to actually explain the process of everything. So I bet that just cuts quite a lot of guff out, actually, by you going, oh yeah, I know that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Can we quickly, well, not quickly, but can we speak about your work, what exactly you do? Because I know there's a lot of probably misconception out there about psychology, psychologists, the difference between that and counselling and psychotherapy.
Yes.
Can we touch on that?
Yeah.
CBT, all of that stuff.
Yes. Yeah. It's a big old topic, so I will try and be brief. But so there is counselling, psychotherapy and psychology. Why it's complicated is because actually lots of these aren't protected titles. So anyone can call themselves a psychologist, for example. You don't have to have a certain level of training to call yourself a psychologist or to call yourself a counsellor or to call yourself a psychotherapist. So there's also, even within that, there's people that are pretending to be these things that aren't really them because they haven't done the training.
Oh
my clinical God. Psychology, because clinical psychologist is a protective title. So like that's one, and counselling psychologist. So like it's clearer to know what you're getting with people that have that training, just because of that. So that kind of cut through stuff sometimes. But ultimately, psychotherapists have, this is hard because I haven't done psychotherapy training or counselling training, so I can't, it's hard for me to speak on it. But there's fundamental differences in our training. Clinical psychologists have a doctorate in clinical psychology. They have to have done an undergrad and then a doctorate. So we've had about probably minimum 7 or 8 years training before qualifying. And we train in lots of different models of therapy. So the idea is that we're very formulation-based, which means we make sense of the person's problem, think about what's going on, and then use all the tools we've gained in our doctorate, all the different training, to pick the one that's right for them, or sometimes a lot of different ones, and pull it all together based on what's going on for the client. Counselling typically is much more a kind of space to offload and talk, but that... which is so helpful for so many people, but it's less you're not expecting necessary masses change. You're just kind of getting it off your chest. In the moment it feels good, but you're not necessarily going to see a big shift. That being said, obviously you can do, and you do, people do see change. And some counsellors have lots of different training and other models like CBT, and so then there becomes a massive overlap between counselling and counselling and clinical psychology, because you can, and psychotherapy, because we can all train in the same models.
Right.
Wow.
So it gets complicated. It's very complicated. If you have just, but counsellors can train themselves up to have almost the same training as they can be a specialist in CBT, and so can a clinical psychologist, but they wouldn't have the doctorate basis underneath it. Does that make sense?
And so if a person, and lots of people will be, looking for extra support, looking for help, where should they start? Or what's the best advice to finding someone to support you?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think so much about it for me. I think basically most of the research shows that the therapeutic relationship is one of the biggest impacts in change. So what I would say is anyone you find, you should try and do a chat with them, like a 15-minute free consultation. Most people offer them. Check to see if you're a good fit. Even if you do have a paid session or find someone and have a session, you can have one session and decide it doesn't work for you. If it feels not good in that session, then it's probably not the right person. You should move on. If it feels not good because people are asking you different questions about your life, that's not the same thing. It's about if it feels bad in the relationship. Like therapy, obviously, a lot of the time feels a bit uncomfortable because we make people go to places that feel hard. Otherwise, you'd just be chatting with a friend, right? So it's not about that. It's about whether it feels okay, like the gentle push, you know, gentle nudging, and that feels, you know, it feels like a good fit. But to find people, there are lots of different directories. Also, there's the NHS. Like if... you know, that's, I guess, really important to say. Therapy is expensive. Counsellors, psychotherapists and clinical psychologists charged slightly differently. Probably in that order, as a typical rule, counselling is cheaper than psychotherapy, than clinical psychology. But that is dependent on the training that counsellors and psychotherapists have. But yeah, so the NHS does have free psychological support for everyone. It comes with a wait list. It comes with limited sessions. It comes with maybe not being able to choose your therapist. You know, it comes with all the downsides to the NHS, but it is there and an option. So go to your GP and ask for support is one of the easiest ways to get some support. But then there's directories like Counselling Directory or Psychology Today, or there's the world of Instagram, where you can find therapists. You can also reach out to me, and I really mean it. I've got a wait list. I'm not trying to drum up business. Like, I will help people find the support that kind of is right for them, that fits their kind of the amount they can pay and things like that. I just want people to be able to access support, because it's so, like, and you asked me about the work I do. I guess the work I mostly do is the trauma of infertility, so I do huge amounts of work. So I'm EMDR trained, which is I don't know if you heard of this. Yeah,
what is
rapid
that?
Eye eye movement reprocessing. Hold on, yeah. EMDR. I missed one. Eye movement. I'm really dyslexic, and I have moments where my brain just literally can't find words. So I apologise, but it's about your eye movements, basically. Yeah. But I actually don't use eye movements. I use tapping from side to side. But we call it bilateral stimulation. It's that side to side movement, same as the eye movements. And what we do is use that whilst we're going to a traumatic moment in our lives, and it kind of helps you keep one foot in the present and one foot in the past, and it helps us process. When we have traumatic experiences, our memories aren't stored in the same way as other memories, which means they pop into our minds when we don't choose for them to be, because they're not kind of processed in the same way. So for example, that might be like an actual flashback would be an example of it popping in without us choosing, but also just in those moments when we like walk back into the clinic and our body just responds like it did when we were in that moment when we had that bad experience, or, you know, we go to the loo and see blood and it triggers that, you know, like all that is our trauma in our bodies. And so I use EMDR to help process those traumas so that people can put them away more neatly in their memory box. It doesn't get rid of them, but it means that we have more control over when they pop up, and things like going to the loo or going to the clinic are less triggering because we've processed them and dealt with them. So that's one of the biggest bits of work I do.
Wow, that's amazing. So fascinating. Can I ask, when you're working with, you know, I know that you've had experience working with a wide range of people in different areas, but when you're working with someone who's suffering infertility, whether that's primary or secondary, I've heard that, you know, it's quite like someone processing a life-changing, life-altering sort of disease, as it were. I mean, the World Health Organization actually classes infertility as a disease. And everyone's always quite shocked. My husband was really shocked by that when he had a session with the NHS counsellor, and she said that, and he was like, what? And she's like, yeah. So I just wondered, you know, when you see people and the way that they're dealing with it, are you able to, how can you help people move past it? How do you do that? It's so hard.
And I think it, like, I would change the question, because I don't think you can move past infertility if you're still in infertility, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is changing how you manage it. And I don't mean that people are managing it badly if they're struggling. Like, I think that's literally all my Instagram feed is for, right? Like, this is understandable. You're struggling. It's all bloody awful. And of course you're, you know, doing the Googling. Of course you're staying back from events because all of it's triggering, you know. So I think some of it's really normalising. But I think what we do often as humans is we have our pain, which is the pain of a health condition, like you're talking about, or the pain of infertility, and we can often add a whole nother of layer of suffering on top of that pain, which is, I should be doing better, I should be working harder, this is my fault, it's something I did, or maybe it's because I had a C-section because I was useless, you know, like all that stuff that you can beat yourself up for. And so a lot of the other work I do is compassion focused work, which is helping people just be kinder to themselves on the journey. And it sounds so fluffy, but it's like, honestly, I've I've done CFT work on myself, and it's like one of the hardest things you can do, I think, to try and actually be kind, bring kindness to yourself on this journey or on any journey, because we're just not built for self-compassion, really. We're all, you know, society makes us so, like, if we're harsh on ourselves, we work really hard, make ourselves, you know, work all the hours in the sun or whatever, we'll get where we want. It's like that view that if we were doing the right things, we'd be getting the result we wanted. That's how we like learn really.
And yeah. I think especially as women, I think we do that too. Yeah. We're very hard on ourselves.
Absolutely.
I just thought as well, we kind of wanted to touch on maybe some of the main topics or main sort of things that people really need mm-hmm. help with. There are going to be people struggling with the same similar themes, right? Be mm-hmm. it jealousy, be mm-hmm. it kind of resentment, yes. be yeah. it feeling left behind or grief, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. I know this is a big mm-hmm. thing, but what are the things you see most? And yeah. what can we sort of do to manage these things that yeah. we all have, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all of those. I see all of those probably yeah. every day that I have a clinic. I think the biggest thing, you know, like that I can give away right now is the kind, like, to allow your space for those feelings. If you feel jealous of your friend, you haven't chose to feel jealous of that friend. You don't choose your feelings, right? So when we beat ourselves up for our feelings, it makes no sense whatsoever because you didn't choose to. It's like beating yourself up for having brown hair if you've got brown hair. Like, didn't you have brown hair? You just had brown hair. Like, it's not a good example because you're going to dye your hair, but you know what I mean. Like, it's beating yourself up for something you've not had a choice over, right? So it doesn't make sense. So if you can give yourself space to be jealous and hold space for both things, you can be pleased for your friend and jealous that they've got what you want. You can, you know, feel left behind and feel pleased your friends are moving forward. You can have space for both feelings. And I think allowing yourself to be open to the idea, rather than just going, I'm such a horrible person because I'm jealous of my friend, or I'm such a horrible person because I can't move on from this, or I'm being so boring, or I'm not handling this well enough, I should be doing better, I should be going out more, I should be working harder at this, I should be Googling more to find answers. You know, all of that, that's the internal world that I see daily, you know, that inner space that your head goes to. If we could be kinder to ourselves and leave space for those feelings, then it allows us to move on more easily from them, because otherwise we get stuck on them. It's like, you know, if I tell you not to think of a pink elephant, then it's the first thing you do. It's such a simple example, but, you know, if you tell yourself not to do X or think Y, then you just almost build it up more, and it's more likely to get bigger because you're not giving it space to allow it to just be.
Is there one sort of, or what's the thing that people come to you the most with? Is there a
I think because of my skill set, I think trauma EMD, you know, the trauma of infertility is one of the things that people come to me for, you
is
know
that physical, so like, trauma sort of,
yeah, it's like it's worse, it's flashbacks to kind of the negative tests or the clinic spaces, but more often it's that you know, like, for example, I've had multiple clients that can't go back to the bathroom where they had their miscarriage.
Oh my God.
An inability to go into their own bathroom because that's reminding them too much of that experience. So we do the work to help get them back there through EMDR. It just, and it's amazing when it works, and it's, you know, it's one of the most amazing therapies, honestly, I believe. And you can get to a place where they can go into that bathroom and not feel that, like, I need to get out of here and panicky situation. That fight off, basically, when you're in trauma, when you get triggered, you're in fight or flight again. You're back to that time where it happened. It's hard to differentiate. You think you're still in that trauma where that really bad thing happened. And EMDR is basically getting people to be in a place where they've put it back in the past. That, you know, they realise it's not happened to them in the moment. It's something that has happened.
Here's another question, just that, you know, I don't know if this... I feel like, with people I know and... I'm not sure if this resonates with you as well, Catherine, but, you know, quite often when people are in trauma, they don't always know until it's really bad. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just wondered at what stage, if there's anyone listening right now who is struggling really hard and they might be isolating themselves from events, from people, not getting back to people, maybe not being able to go to work and focus on things, or, you know, not finding it hard to do the things that they used to be able to do. At what point would you suggest, like, this, you really need to speak to somebody, even if it's your NHS, your GP, or, you know, at what point? Because people often don't know.
They can't like, see the signs.
Yeah, they can't see it. They don't know. They're like, I think it's just because I'm feeling this way and it will pass and I'll just deal with it.
Yeah. And I hear that so much, like, oh, I should be doing, but I shouldn't be struggling. Like, I have the, lots of my clients will say to me, oh, I'm only a year in, like, you know, I haven't even started IVF yet. Why am I struggling? You know, there's all that, the comparison between other people's pain, and like, I call it, kind of call it like reverse top trumps, where people are like, well, they've got it worse, so I can't feel bad about my experience, you know? So there's that whole thing that plays a role in help seeking. And I guess I would say that if your life's been impacted, if you are enjoying life less, if you are feeling anxious constantly, if you are not sleeping, if you're, it's impacting your appetite, you know, all the things, if you've noticed anything, really, there's no bad time or wrong time to access support. If you feel like you need it, if you've noticed a big change in your life, like, obviously infertility is really hard, like, it's really difficult. And I to be honest, I don't think many people in out there, that if we had endless amounts of money, it wouldn't be good to meet with someone once a week and talk about your stuff if you're in the world of infertility, right? Because there's so much to unpack and make sense of. But equally, it's those times where you are like, you're not doing the things you used to enjoy, that you're so anxious you can't relax, that you're spending hours on Google every night without being able to stop or have a boundary. You know, they're the times to see, to step out and think, actually, this isn't okay. Like, I've completely lost, like, the way I describe it is having completely lost myself through infertility, you know. If you feel like you can't recognize yourself anymore, that's definitely a time that therapy would be helpful.
Okay. And I think what should be said as well, sometimes it's your partner that picks. I know for me, it's my husband that picks up when I'm not okay. And then when he just, if he notices something, I'm like, something's off. Yeah. But on that, in that as well, we shouldn't forget the partners, be it, you know, male partners with a female, if it's a heteronormative couple, or, you know, in same-sex couples, there might be one partner that's not injecting or carrying, etc. So,
or single, if you're single going through it alone.
Yeah, but like, partners, I feel like, can get very sidelined in that too. Do you see a lot of partners coming to you for support?
Not as many as I'd like.
And men especially, any male fertility people?
Only through couples work. So I'm trained in couples therapy as well. So I see people as couples in the infertility space and have done that. But I haven't yet seen a male through my door for infertility on their own.
Oh my gosh.
I think sometimes they need strong arming. I'm not talking about my husband, who is very, I'm very lucky. I mean, he's done a lot of work himself on coming to terms and being open. He's, a different kettle of fish. But I feel like a lot of women might have to strong arm their husbands to talk to someone.
Definitely. Exactly. And then if they're in from that point, if they're only there on someone else's terms, then they're not going to have a great experience, and then they're going to think therapy is useless anyway. Do you know what I mean? It's so hard. Yeah. It's, you can lead a horse to water, you know, that kind of vibe. So I think I think the world is changing, and there will be a time where it becomes a bit more normal, I think. But I think, you know, men seek support less in almost all areas of mental health. And, you know, in the fertility space where it's so focused on the woman, right? Like, even when male factor is the bigger part to play, you know, the woman's the one that does all the IVF treatment, and it like, the industry's focused on us too. That's where they realise they'll make their money if we tell women that they aren't thinking positively enough, and you can sell them some affirmations, or, well, you know, they all it all focuses on the woman. And so the man does get left behind, and that is really hard. So I think it would be great if people, you know, it's in an area that impacts men massively, like the idea that they can't have the family they want, that they might be playing a role in not being able to give their partner, who they can see is being crushed by this, the child they want. You know, there's so much to it, just equally as much as with women, that what they don't have is the kind of hormonal imbalances that happen through the fertility treatment, which is another big part of the fertility world and how it impacts our mental health. But other than that, they're seeing it all, they're experiencing it all. They can get something called secondary trauma, which is where you're traumatized by being with someone in trauma, if that makes sense.
Oh my God, wow.
Yeah, so like it's really hard, but yeah, it's just not as normalized, I think. They think they need to be strong for the woman. Often, if it's a male, if it's heteronormative couple,
and if they can, and they want to be the fixer, get their ticket out.
Yeah, that's it. It's that fixing.
That's what Andrew's like.
I know that Carl has, and again, he's better at dealing with it now. But in the darkest days, he still says, "You can find someone else, and it's my fault, and all of this is because of me." And those are really dark thoughts that are horrible to listen
to.
And
really
luckily,
hard.
And luckily, he can go, "I know that's not logical. I know." But in the dark days, it still gets
still
to
there,
especially with a male factor. So yeah. I think there are brilliant people doing brilliant stuff out there for male fertility, like Test Him with Ian Stones and Sean and Kieran from Male Fertility and Nexus. But we've got more work to do, haven't we?
Yeah, and I think in a way it would be great to have a male therapist out there doing like a similar thing to me, because I don't people like my content is so much about my experience. Actually, I'm not really tapping. I get why a man wouldn't kind of reach out to me necessarily, because so much of it is tapping into my experience and therefore like the female experience in a way, or the or the person in treatment, I should say, because I think that's it. I think though, even with kind of same-sex couples, it's the couple that's not it's the partner that's not having the treatment that's the one that feels they need to be the strong one, hold it together, because it's the you know, the other person that's going through through their stuff.
I was gonna ask just a quick one for those who might be listening, and because another, I think, slight taboo around infertility is how it affects relationships. You know, you often hear how strong we are and how great we're doing, but actually there'll be a lot of people listening who have relationships, and actually it's really hard on their relationships. And I just wondered, what is there anything that you would, I don't know what situations might come about, but I mean, you know, any advice for those who might be listening who are like, I feel so disconnected, we're both not on the same page, like how do you navigate that?
And I think I would start this by saying, like, I'm not immune to this. Like, we're 3.5 years into our fertility journey. There's been ups and downs in our relationship, because I think what happens is when you're in the worst place you've been in your life, you go to like your worst coping strategies often, right? And if you're doing that in your coupled relationship, then that often leads to not great communication, and like you're both in a difficult stress spot, so you can't look after each other in the same way as you necessarily do if like only one person's affected by the issue. You're both being affected, so you're both, you know, not the best versions of yourselves in those moments. So of course you snap when you didn't want to, or you know, whatever it is, or you disconnect because it's just easier than kind of talking about all the trauma or IVF or that sort of thing. But I would say, I think the key thing is to, what I hear most, the two things I hear most is typically women really struggling with their partner not understanding them, so not like just trying to pull them out of their feelings, you know, like you don't need to worry, it's going to work next time, or it's just a negative test, we'll try again next month, or like, oh, maybe we'll just try this, it'll be fine, you know, like they try, our partner struggled to see us feeling really sad. And so what they want to do is they want to pull us out of those feelings, and that to us feels really minimizing, and like you're not experiencing it, you're not understanding how I'm feeling in that moment. And that is a dynamic I see so regularly, and it's so hard. But I think one of the things is just like realizing that actually it's so important just to see each other where each other are. Like, actually you need to, I kind of stay, get in the mud with someone. Like, what people need is for their partner to get in the mud with them, see what it's like down here, see what it's like in it in there before they can start trying to clamber out together. Like, you need that space where you can just be the shittest version of yourself. You need your partner to be able to accept that.
And it makes you feel together, doesn't it? That's the thing.
The moments when your partner actually can open up and say how hard it is, they're the moments where you're like, oh, I'm not alone in this. You feel just as bad as, you know, you're struggling just as much as I do. And they see that as a lack of strength often, but what you see it as is like, I'm not alone in this. Like, they care as much, and we're in it together. So I would say, like, just trying to see each other's points of view more, giving each other grace. You're not always going to communicate as effectively, you know, draw a line under it, come back to it on a different day. Like, it's just kindness again, really. And then the other thing I see is like a similar vibe, but the one's the researcher and one's the avoidant and not think about it. And that causes loads of dynamics. Like the researcher thinks, oh, I care more because I'm doing all the researching. Why does they not care as much? And then the non-researcher going, they're going mental doing all this research. It's not going to actually make a blind bit of difference. Like, just, I just want to spend some time together, not thinking about fertility. And then it just, you get further and further apart. But I think that is just mainly an appreciation for both of you. Both of them are anxiety responses to the situation. You know, you're just responding differently to the situation. So one's using their anxiety to research and one's using their anxiety to avoid. And
I definitely feel that a little bit with us. Sometimes Carl just goes, I need a few days where we don't talk about IVF. We don't talk about fertility. And actually, that used to really upset me. I'm like, but take it seriously. Yeah. But now I go, oh, all right. Oh, okay. That's just what you need in this moment. But like, sometimes he's like, okay, can we have, not even like a day, 10 minutes. Can we have half an hour?
Yeah. And it's one of the things I actually recommend, like, you know, have some designated, we will not talk about fertility time. Because what happens is, the same as we lose ourselves with fertility, we lose our relationship as a couple. Like, physically, like, you know, like our sex has become this like thing that makes a baby rather than anything, you know, like it impacts sex, it impacts like date night, it impacts so much. So you lose yourselves as a couple. So like actually having time for you, the two of you, outside of all the stress of it, where you can just do the things you used to enjoy together, pre-fertility.
So important.
So important.
That's so helpful.
Grace, can we talk about your business, please? Hope in Mind.
Yeah, so Hope in Mind Psychology. It's very recent. Well, it's not recent. It was just a different name up until very recently. But it's my private psychology business, and it's kind of pretty small at the moment. I just left the NHS in August last year. But it's my private practice, and at some point, I guess the hopeful plan is to grow it. But there's not much to say really, because it is just me at the moment. So what I've described, the therapy I do, that is the business currently.
Though to, you know, you've got kind of full control over that. It's your thing. It's been so lovely. You can have it exactly as you want, you know. So that must be fantastic.
Amazing. A waiting list as well.
It's going well.
You're doing really well.
Smashing it.
When I left the NHS, honestly, I cried. Like, I just cried and cried and cried. Like, when I qualified as a clinical psychologist, all I wanted to do was work for the NHS trained me. All I wanted to do was work for the NHS, and it just became untenable to stay there. I've been in the perinatal world for years, and I couldn't think about being in the NHS and not doing that job. And there's no fertility therapy in the NHS that doesn't exist, you know.
Wow.
Like, you can, when I say you can go to the NHS for support, you'll get a generic therapist
We got offered NHS counselling through our clinic, which we're lucky to have, but again, it's not quite the same for me personally. I found the counselling didn't quite go deep enough, so that's very true.
And you get that because your clinic will have that as part of their private option. That isn't always the case, that everyone can access that, but they can get some support, but it's not specialist fertility support, and I don't want to be in a generic mental health, you know, like I like specializing and really getting into a topic and being really good at it, if I'm honest. I want to be able to really help people and know exactly what they need and what I can do to support them. So yeah, like I was so sad leaving the NHS, because I was just leaving a job I absolutely loved and had worked a really bloody hard time to train for, but actually starting this business and the Instagram account at the same time and like growing it has like really given me, like, thinking about that focus outside of fertility, that's what it's like, it's given me some like new energy in a different area of my life where like things had just got a bit like, you know, everything's a bit bleh.
And creative as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And your Instagram, where can people find you on Instagram?
I am the Not So Fertile Psychologist on Instagram. So you can find me there. Yeah.
And everyone, I would recommend giving Grace a follow, because, as I say, I found you in every post. I was like, yes, just like clap emoji for all of them.
I should also say, because she will tell me if I don't, is that I'm doing some work for Katie for Fertility Action as well.
Yes,
I know Emma talked about her, about the Fertility Action as well. But Yeah, so I'm going to be doing some work for her charity. I'm always already helping with the support groups, which I'll kind of be taking a lead on. But I also
felt the Fertility Action Network. That's Katie Rollings.
Katie Rollings, yep, that's it.
Yeah,
you're doing a support group tonight, aren't you?
I am doing a support group tonight. Yes,
better not keep you too long.
So I should mention her because you know they're doing amazing things at Fertility Action,
The infertility community is just getting stronger by the day.
Oh my God,
I think
it's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's such a great thing to be a part of.
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah. I have one little question that might wrap us up quite nicely.
Yeah, go on.
And that's, we are called IVF BFF because we found each other, went through IVF, Sean and I, at the same time, and we connected and we realised that we had an IVF BFF. That's someone to, like, you know, share it all with. And the aim is for us to be everyone else's IVF BFFs. Do you have an IVF BFF?
I don't.
No!
We could be your IVF BFF.
Do you know what? Thank you. Do you know what? It's really sad, but like when I started this journey, I had people in the same boat with me, like my friends experiencing secondary infertility and not getting pregnant. And, you know, 3.5 years in, they just...
Have they all left you?
They've left me. Yeah. You know, they have, which is great. They have their success, which is so what you want. But they didn't get to the point of needing the fertility treatment. So really, they don't understand in the same level. Yeah. You know, I have a few good friends that have gone through fertility treatment for sure, but no one that's in it has been in it with me sharing a similar process.
Well, can we be your IVF BFFs,
yes,
please?
Yes, absolutely, of course. Yay. I was literally, when I listened to your first podcast, I was like, oh my God, you guys, you have exactly what I want. That sounds lovely.
Oh, that's so cute. Yeah. Love it. I think we should make it a thing. I think more people need an IVF BFF.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It would be so good. Yeah.
Fab. Aww, well, thanks for
anything
so
else?
Much. Yeah.
No,
is that
I don't
it?
Think so.
No. Amazing. Well, yeah.
We've loved having you.
Yeah,
really.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so appreciative of being on. It's been great.
Thank you, Grace. Yeah. This is absolutely amazing. We're so lucky to have got you. And I think there's some brilliant advice and info, and it's just great to hear your story as well. Great to hear someone else's story. So thank you.
Yeah, thank
You're
you.
You're so welcome.
All right. There we go. That was the lovely Grace.
Wow, Dr. Grace Lee Brindle. Isn't she amazing?
Amazing.
What a gal.
Yeah, I felt like I learned a lot.
Yeah, and as well, just hopefully there's so many little nuggets of info for people, and also just to hear someone else's story and to hear, you know, I'm hoping it might be quite reassuring, especially for those experiencing secondary, which obviously we don't have any experience in.
No.
Yeah.
And I hope people that are listening, because I'm, you know, that might have been quite a hard listen as well for people. I just hope that everyone listening is okay.
Yeah. You know, it's just more infertility, isn't it? And like, oh gosh. And everyone's story is so, so different. And it just makes you realise. And you know what? When she was talking about everything she's going through, and she's so apologetic to us about already having a child, which is so sensitive and thoughtful, because obviously she knows that we are in the primary bracket. But listening to it, I'm like, God, nobody deserves this. And whether it's primary or secondary, it's just mind-blowing what we go through. You know, so sending everyone lots of love if they're in a similar position.
But also, I guess from listening to that, some people may actually recognize that they might need a bit of guidance, mightn't they, as well?
100%. And to maybe like to know where to start in looking for some help.
Yeah. So I hope that was helpful, everybody.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's another ep in the bag.
Yeah, and I hope everyone has a nice Easter. Eat some more chocolate.
Yes, this will hopefully be coming to you Easter Monday. Yeah. Hope everyone's eating their weight in chocolate.
Yeah.
And if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Instagram at
IVFBFFpod.
You can email us at
IVFBFFpod@gmail.com.
Woohoo! Woo. And come and have a chat with us, basically. We love it.
Yeah, we do. We do love it. So, yeah, I hope you all have a lovely week, everyone.
All right, everyone. See you later.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.